Imagine for a second that the entire world is a giant, intricate clock.
A beautiful mechanical clock.
Exactly. And for, what, 300 years or so, that's precisely how we've treated the law. You have a cause, you have an effect. Gears turn, levers pull.
Mm-hmm.
If you know the input, let's call it input A, you will inevitably, 100% of the time, get output B.
It's precise. It's predictable. It's what people call the clockwork universe.
And it's comforting, right?
Well, it's a very comforting worldview. It's the bedrock of Newtonian physics, sure. But it's also, I mean, it's the bedrock of the but-for test in negligence law.
Right.
The whole assumption is that if we can just rewind the tape of history and press play again, mm-hmm. everything would unfold in exactly the same way. Determinism, stability.
Exactly. But here is the problem. And honestly, it's the reason we're sitting here today. That clock is breaking.
Or maybe we're just realizing it was never really a clock to begin with.
That's a better way to put it. We're entering 2026, and the machinery of our world, and by extension, our entire legal system, is shifting right beneath our feet. We are moving from a world that is deterministic, where A always leads to B.
To a world that is probabilistic, where A leads to a distribution of B. A range of possible outcomes.
And that shift isn't just happening in some high-level physics lab somewhere.
No, not at all. It's happening in data centers, in encryption standards, in corporate boardrooms, and, you know, very, very soon it's going to be happening inside your courtroom.
Which brings us to the topic of today's deep dive. We are unpacking a brand new, and I would argue, groundbreaking online course that claims to be the roadmap for this new reality.
A guide for the legal profession.
It's titled Quantum Law. From causation to probability AI, quantum computing, and the future of legal judgment.
And before you panic, you know, thinking we're about to ask you to solve complex equations or derive Schrodinger's equation, let me just stop you right there.
Yeah, please do. My calculus is a little rusty.
This course is not for physicists. It is explicitly designed for legal professionals. We're talking about lawyers, judges, paralegals, legal tech experts, law students.
Everyone in the ecosystem.
Exactly. It's what you might call a competence course.
I love that term, a competence course. It isn't about learning to build the machine.
Nothing.
It's about learning how not to get run over by it.
Or how to cross-examine it.
Even better. And we have to talk about the creator of this course because he is a bit of a legend in the legal tech space. Ralph Lucey.
Absolutely. If you've worked in e-discovery or legal tech any time in the last 20 years, you know that name. He's a retired trial lawyer, but he's best known as the pioneer behind the landmark De Silva Moore case.
That was back in 2012, right?
2012, Southern District of New York. The predictive coding case.
That was the predictive coding case, right?
The landmark one. That was the very first time a court in the United States officially approved the use of AI, specifically predictive coding, or TAR in discovery.
So he saw this AI revolution coming a full decade before ChatGPT became a household name.
He was writing and litigating about it way ahead of the curve. And now he's turned his focus to the next revolution, quantum computing. He's essentially saying, look, I told you AI was coming, and now I'm telling you quantum is coming, and it's going to be even bigger.
So the mission for this deep dive is pretty simple. We're going to walk you through the five classes of Ralph Lucey's course. We're going to see why quantum isn't just sci-fi anymore.
It's an engineering reality.
An engineering reality that affects your client's secrets, your evidence, and frankly, the very nature of truth itself.
And we should clarify, the promise of this course is that you don't need a math degree. The whole goal is to put you ahead of the curve for the next 10, maybe 20 years. It's about building a mental model so you can advise clients and argue cases in this new era.
Okay, let's jump right in then. Class one. This is titled Foundations, the Quantum Edge of Law. And getting right into it, Ralph, I feel like we can call him Ralph, starts by dismantling that whole clockwork universe we just talked about.
Tearing it down.
He introduces the shift from bits to qubits. Now, we hear these buzzwords all the time, but what is the functional difference for a lawyer? What does it actually mean?
Well, the best way to visualize it, and Ralph uses this analogy in the course, is to think about a maze.
Okay.
Imagine a classical computer. The laptop on your desk, the phone in your pocket, is a mouse running through that maze.
Okay, I'm picturing the little mouse scurrying around.
This mouse is looking for a piece of cheese, which, you know, represents the solution to a problem.
Mm-hmm.
The mouse is fast. It's incredibly fast. It runs down one path, hits a wall, turns around, goes back, marks that path as a no, and then it tries the next path.
It's sequential.
It checks path A, then path B, then path C. Even if it's doing a billion operations a second, it's still checking them one by one. That's a bit. It's a switch. It is either zero or one. on or off, a dead end or not a dead end.
Got it. So what about the quantum computer using qubits?
The quantum computer isn't a mouse.
Okay.
It is water. Imagine pouring a bucket of water into the entrance of the maze.
Mm-hmm.
The water doesn't choose a path. It doesn't try path A, then path B. It floods all the paths at once.
Ah.
It finds the exit, not by trying them one at a time, but by flowing through the entire structure simultaneously. The solution, the cheese, is revealed by where the water flows.
That is such a powerful image, and you can see immediately why that matters for things like encryption or, you know, logistics optimization. If a lock has a billion combinations, the mouse takes a billion tries. The water just...
It just fills the lock and finds the opening almost instantaneously.
Mm.
It's a massive parallel processing power that's unlike anything we've ever had before.
Right.
And in class one, Ralph breaks down three core concepts, or maybe behavior is a better word,
yeah,
of this water-like system that lawyers need to understand conceptually.
Not mathematically, but conceptually.
Exactly. The first is superposition, which is basically what we just described.
Hmm.
It's the ability of a qubit to hold conflicting states 0 and 1 at the same time. The water is in all paths at once.
Which, ironically, sounds like a lawyer's brain on a good day. It depends, right? Holding two conflicting arguments in your head until the judge picks one.
It's funny you say that because it's a good analogy. But in computing, it's what allows for this massive optimization. So that's concept one. The second concept is entanglement.
And this is where things get really spooky, to quote Einstein.
Now, his term for it.
Spooky.
Action at a distance.
This is the magic coins analogy from the course notes. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. Imagine you have two coins. They're special quantum coins.
Mm-hmm.
You keep one and you give one to a friend who travels to the other side of the galaxy. Light years away.
Okay.
If those coins are entangled, the moment you flip your coin and it lands on heads, instantly, and I mean faster than the speed of light, your friend's coin also lands on heads every single time. They're perfectly correlated no matter the distance.
Physics-wise, that is mind-bending. But Ralph brings us back to a law lens. Why does a product liability lawyer need to care about magic coins on the other side of the universe?
Because of what it implies about systems and failure. In a classical machine, like a car engine, if a piston breaks, you can isolate it. You can say, that specific part is broken. The parts are individuals.
Right. The cause is localized.
Exactly. But in a quantum system, because of entanglement, the qubits are inextricably linked. They aren't acting as individuals. They are acting as one massive unified state.
So if one part fails,
the whole system collapses. The whole thing decoheres. Ralph calls this fragility and contagion. Legally, this complicates causation and liability enormously. You can't easily point to a defective part when the system operates as a unified whole.
It's not a single bad gear.
It's a system-wide decoherence. An error can cascade through the entire system instantly.
That is going to be a nightmare for litigation. Who broke the quantum computer? Well, nobody touched it. The universe just looked at it funny and it decoupled.
Essentially.
What?
And that leads to the third concept he introduces, which is tunneling.
Which is pretty much exactly what it sounds like, right?
It is. In classical physics, if a ball doesn't have enough energy to roll over a hill, what does it do?
It rolls back down. Gravity wins.
Gravity wins. In quantum physics, there is a non-zero probability that the particle just appears on the other side. It tunnels through the barrier without ever having the energy to climb it.
And the legal application here is optimization again.
Right. It helps algorithms escape what are called local minima. Imagine you're trying to find the lowest point in a huge hilly landscape. That's the best solution to your problem. A classical computer might roll down into a small valley and stop, thinking it found the bottom.
But there might be a much deeper valley just over the next ridge.
Exactly. The classical computer gets stuck in that suboptimal valley. The quantum computer, because of tunneling, can just pop through the ridge and find the true global optimal answer.
So class one is really about building that intuition. You don't need to do the math, but you need to know that the water floods the maze, the coins are connected, and the particle can walk through walls.
That's it. It's about reaching level one and two literacy. You need the intuition so that later, you know, when you're cross-examining a witness about a quantum simulation, you understand the fundamental behavior of the machine you're dealing with. You aren't easily fooled.
Which is a perfect lead-in to class two. Because if class one is the cool science foundation, class two is the scary reality.
This is where it gets very practical.
The title is The Threat Q-Day and the Death of Secrets.
This is where the rubber meets the road for every single legal professional. We move from theory to the most immediate risk, confidentiality. If you're general counsel or on a law firm's executive committee, this is the class that should make you sit up straight.
And Ralph makes a really important distinction here right at the start. He says lawyers, and most people really, confuse passwords with encryption keys.
It is a very, very common mistake.
Yeah.
A password is just the doorman. It checks your ID. If you have a weak password, you're just tricking the doorman, maybe with a fake ID. But encryption keys, that's the vault wall itself. It's the physics of the lock.
And current encryption relies on math that is really, really hard for a classical mouse computer to solve.
Exactly. It's usually based on factoring huge prime numbers. A classical computer would have to try combinations for, you know, longer than the age of the universe to break it.
But the quantum water.
The quantum water solves it directly. A quantum computer doesn't guess your password. It dissolves the walls of the vault. It finds the prime factors of the encryption key directly using something called Shor's algorithm. And this brings us to the concept of Q-Day.
Q-Day? It sounds like a summer blockbuster movie title.
It does, but Ralph is careful to emphasize that it isn't a single calendar date circled in red. It's more like an event horizon. It's the threshold where quantum computers become stable enough and powerful enough to break public key encryption, the standard used for everything from your bank account to your client's sealed medical records.
And here's the part that really terrified me when I read the source material for this class. The strategy known as Harvest Now, Decrypt Later, HNDL.
This is the stuff of nightmares for corporate security officers and national security agencies. The idea is devastatingly simple.
Tell us.
Adversaries, we're talking state actors, sophisticated criminal organizations, are stealing encrypted data right now. Today, they are siphoning it off the internet in massive quantities.
But they can't read it yet.
Not yet. To them, it just looks like scrambled garbage. But they are storing it. They're harvesting it and putting it on hard drives, just waiting.
They're waiting for Q-Day.
Exactly. They are waiting for the machine that can dissolve the vault. And here's the implication for you as a legal professional. Suppose you're holding trade secrets for a client, or medical records, or sealed court documents involving a minor that need to remain secret for 20 years.
Okay. But Q-Day is estimated to be maybe, what, 10 years away? Some say less, some say more.
Let's use 10 years as an example. If your data needs to be secure for 20 years, but the tool to break its security will exist in 10, then your data is already compromised. It is already gone.
The breach has effectively already happened. The physics just hasn't caught up to the crime yet.
That is the perfect way to put it. The theft is complete, pending decryption.
Ralph introduces a formula for this, right? It's called Mosca's inequality.
Yes. It's a simple equation, but a terrifying one. It basically says, if the time it takes you to migrate all your systems to new quantum-resistant encryption.
Which could be years for a big company.
Years. So that time, PLUS, the required shelf life of your secrets. If that sum is greater than the time remaining until Q-Day, you have a very serious problem.
That's the hidden timing trap. So if it takes my firm 5 years to upgrade all our document management systems and my client's M&A secrets need to last 20 years, that's 25 years of needed protection.
Right.
But if Q-Day is only 15 years away, I'm already 10 years too late.
You're already underwater. And this is why taking a course like this is so vital. It shifts your perspective from, oh, quantum is a future problem I'll deal with later, to I need to look at my vendor contracts today.
And that is the solution Ralph points to. It's not hopeless. The solution is post-quantum cryptography, or PQC.
Right. And this isn't science fiction. The National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, released new standards for this back in 2024. You have FIPS 203, 204, 205. These are new mathematical problems that we believe are hard for both classical and quantum computers to solve.
So the course gives you a practical tip. Go check your contracts.
Yes. Are your cloud providers, your e-discovery vendors, your practice management software, are they compliant with these PQC standards? Are they even planning to be? If the answer is no, you're buying a legacy product with a very real expiration date.
He also mentions Apple as a good example of how this is rolling out in the real world already.
Yeah, Apple is already using what is called hybrid encryption for iMessage. Mm-hmm. Now, don't get confused. We're going to talk about hybrid computers later in Class 4. This is hybrid encryption.
So what does that mean?
It means they use two locks on every message. One is the standard classical lock we use today. The other is a new quantum resistant lock based on these PQC principles.
Mm.
So even if a quantum computer picks the first lock on Q-Day,
the second one still holds.
The second one still holds. It's redundant safety. It's a belt and suspenders approach for the quantum age.
I like that. So Class 2 basically scares you into realizing your most precious secrets are vulnerable. Then Class 3 puts you right in the courtroom.
Yes. Quantum evidence and proof.
And this is where we start treating the quantum computer not as a thief trying to break in, but as a witness on the stand.
And this is a massive paradigm shift for how lawyers and judges think about reliability.
Because, as we established with the water in the maze analogy, these machines are probabilistic, not deterministic.
Right. If you ask a classical computer what is 2 + 2, it says 4. If you ask it a million times, it says 4 a million times. It is identical. It's perfectly repeatable.
But a quantum computer is different.
It operates on probability distributions. If you ask it a complex simulation question, say, modeling a car crash or designing a new drug, it might give you an answer that is statistically correct, but the specific numbers might vary slightly every single time you run it.
Okay, so I can see the courtroom scene now. The expert witness presents the quantum simulation results, and the lawyer on the other side stands up and says, "Objection. Your Honor, their machine gave a different answer yesterday. It's clearly malfunctioning."
And that is the trap. That is the fundamental misunderstanding. Ralph explains that it isn't a malfunction, it is physics.
Mm-hmm.
And this brings us to the core legal argument of the entire course, the shift from identity versus fidelity.
Let's unpack that. Identity versus fidelity.
In the classical world, our legal system demands identity. Did the machine give the exact same number? Is the copy bit for bit identical to the original? That is our gold standard for reliability.
Okay.
But in the quantum world, we have to shift our thinking to fidelity. The question becomes, did the machine behave truthfully within its known error bars? Was the process reliable?
Ralph uses the breathalyzer or the radar gun analogy here, which I found really, really helpful.
It's a perfect analogy for lawyers. If a police officer clocks you going 65 miles per hour, and then a second later, the radar gun clocks you at 64 miles per hour, does the judge throw out the ticket because the numbers aren't identical?
Of course not.
No. The judge asks if the variance is within the reliable margin of error for that specific device. We accept that these tools have tolerances. Quantum evidence works the same way, just on a much more complex scale. We aren't looking for bit-perfect repetition. We are looking for a reliable probability distribution.
So to help lawyers navigate this completely new terrain, the course introduces a tool called the reliability ladder.
Yes, this is a practical framework for classifying and challenging quantum-generated evidence. Rung one is the easiest. Classical simulation. That's safe, standard stuff we already know how to handle.
Okay.
Rung two is NISQ. That stands for noisy intermediate scale quantum. This is where we are today. The machines are powerful but noisy, meaning they have inherent error rates. So evidence from an NISQ computer is probabilistic. It absolutely needs error bars attached.
You can't just present the answer. You have to present the answer plus or minus the uncertainty.
You have to. And rung three is a step up from that. It's quantum native verified. This uses clever techniques like echo experiments. It's basically running the computation forward in time and then reversing it to run it backward to see if you get back to your starting point.
A way of checking its own work.
Exactly. It's a way of verifying the fidelity of the calculation without needing a classical computer to check it, which in many cases wouldn't even be possible.
And then there's rung four, which is the danger zone.
Rung four is the oracle or opaque run. This is when a vendor comes in and says, "Trust us, our quantum algorithm is magic. It gives the right answer." Ralph argues this should be presumptively inadmissible. If you can't show the error bars or the verification method, it doesn't come in.
The course walks through a great hypothetical case to illustrate this, Volkoff v. Aragon. It's a patent dispute where one side uses a quantum simulation to discover a new molecule.
And the other side, of course, argues, you can't reproduce this result on a classic computer, so it's inadmissible junk science. The judge's role, and this is the key takeaway, is not to demand certainty.
The judge isn't there to say, is this 100% true?
No. The judge is there to determine, is this probability distribution reliable enough for the jury to consider? It transforms the judge from a gatekeeper of certainty into a gatekeeper of probability.
It really changes the mindset from true-false to confidence intervals.
Which, ironically, is how the law actually works anyway. Beyond a reasonable doubt is just a high confidence interval. Preponderance of the evidence is just over 50%. Quantum just forces us to be honest about the probabilistic nature of proof.
I love that. Okay, so we're building. Moving on to class four, the system AI, quantum, and the control loop. This is where things get really big. We're talking about infrastructure and convergence.
Right. We've had a decade of AI. We've just talked about the fundamentals of quantum. Now, the course asks, what happens when you plug a quantum engine into an AI system?
It stops being just a search tool or a document review tool.
Exactly. It becomes a simulation engine. It can model entire economies, weather systems, logistical chains, things of unimaginable complexity. And Ralph makes a crucial distinction here about two hybrids.
Right, we mentioned this earlier.
In class two, we had hybrid encryption, the two locks for safety. In class four, we're talking about hybrid computing. This is where you have a powerful classical supercomputer handling the logic and the data, but it offloads the impossibly hard math, the optimization problems, to a dedicated quantum chip.
So the classical computer is the brain, and the quantum computer is the intuition, the part that explores all the possibilities at once.
That's a great way to think about it. And this new hybrid system creates what Ralph calls a discovery nightmare. He terms it model-centric law.
This is the missing document hypothetical. I thought this was brilliant because every litigator has faced some version of this.
The setup is this. A massive logistics AI, powered by a quantum optimization engine, reroutes a global fleet of trucks. This causes a massive breach of contract for one of your clients.
Okay, so you sue. And in discovery, you send a request for production. Produce the memo, the email, the document explaining why you rerouted the trucks.
Yeah, and the defendant comes back and says, there is no memo.
There is no document.
Right. The system optimized 10 million scenarios simultaneously, factoring in weather, traffic, fuel costs, and labor rules. And it chose this one. There is no human-readable explanation. There is only the model.
So how do you litigate that? How do you depose a mathematical model?
That is the multi-trillion dollar question. Relevance isn't in a document anymore, it's generated by the model. And Ralph argues that lawyers have to evolve. We have to become supervisors of machine reasoning.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning we can't micromanage the electrons. The math is too hard, it's a black box to us. But we must govern the parameters of the system.
The control loop.
The control loop. Think about a thermostat in your house. You don't tell the furnace the precise chemistry of how to burn natural gas. You just set the temperature range. Keep it between 68 and 72 degrees.
You set the inputs and the constraints.
Exactly. Lawyers in the quantum age will do the same. We will audit and litigate the inputs, the constraints, and the allowable error rates of these massive AI systems. We govern the boundaries of the machine's reasoning.
There is also a very specific and, frankly, scary regulatory trap he mentions here called deemed exports.
Oh, this is a landmine for HR departments and corporate counsel.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. government and others treat quantum technology as highly sensitive, like military hardware.
Okay.
So if you hire a brilliant quantum researcher from a foreign country and you bring them to your lab in the U.S., and you let them look at a schematic of a quantum chip.
You have just exported sensitive technology.
You've exported it, even though nothing ever left the room. It is a deemed export because the knowledge was transferred. You might have just committed a serious federal export violation.
Wow.
So you can see the course isn't just high-level theory. It's warning you about these very specific, very real compliance traps that exist right now.
That is wild. Just looking at a screen can be an act of international export.
Okay, so we built the foundation, we faced the security threats, we have been to court, we have designed the infrastructure. Now, in the final class, class five, Ralph takes us to the edge.
The philosophical edge.
The philosophy law in the shadow of infinity.
This is the fun part. This is where the course really earns its deep dive title. Ralph argues that you can't really understand the implications of quantum law without grappling with what quantum mechanics says about the nature of reality itself.
And he brings in some heavy hitters here to tell the story, starting with Hugh Everett III.
The tragic hero of quantum physics. Back in 1957, Everett was a PhD student at Princeton. He looked at the math of the quantum wave function. Remember the water flooding all the paths in the maze?
The math says the water goes down all the paths. But when we look, we only ever see one outcome. The classical explanation at the time was that the act of observing collapses the wave function. It forces it to choose one path.
And Everett said what?
Everett asked a simple, terrifying question. What if it doesn't collapse? What if the math is literally true? If the math says all outcomes happen, then all outcomes happen.
In different universes.
Exactly. We just happen to inhabit one branch of a constantly splitting reality. This is the many worlds interpretation.
And the scientific establishment at the time completely crushed him for it.
They did. His supervisor, John Wheeler, made him cut it all out of his thesis. He was shut down by the giants of physics like Niels Bohr. He left academia and went into defense work and died relatively young. A tragic story. But today, his theory is one of the leading interpretations of quantum mechanics.
But Ralph doesn't just leave it as a cool theory. He introduces the work of a modern cosmologist, Laura Mersini Houghton.
This is where it gets less speculative and much more evidentiary. Mersini-Houghton theorized that if our universe was born from a larger quantum multiverse, if it kind of tore away from a background of other universes, that violent birth would leave birthmarks on our own universe.
Scars on the sky.
Scars on the sky, yes. She predicted specific anomalies, specific cold spots, in the cosmic microwave background radiation, the afterglow of the Big Bang.
And then?
And then in 2013, the Planck satellite found them. It found the cold spot, a massive void in the universe that shouldn't be there under standard theories. It was a five sigma discovery, a very high level of scientific certainty.
So the multiverse isn't just metaphysics anymore. It might have actual observable fingerprints.
According to her work, yes. And then Ralph connects all of this to Hartmut Nevin, who runs Google's quantum AI lab. Nevin is a builder, not a philosopher. He doesn't care about the theory for its own sake. He just wants his machines to work.
But he has said some pretty wild things.
He has famously said that his quantum machines operate as if they are exploiting resources from parallel realities.
That's the only way he can explain the incredible speed, right?
To him, yes. His logic is, if a calculation should take 10,000 years in our universe, and the quantum computer does it in 3 minutes, where did that extra computing power come from? He argues it comes from tapping into the state space of the multiverse. The water is flowing through mazes in other universes, too.
Okay, so this is mind-blowing stuff, but Ralph always brings it back to the lawyer in the courtroom. So what? Why does a judge need to know about the multiverse?
Because of the act of judgment itself. If reality at its most fundamental level is probabilistic, if at the bottom causation is a distribution of possibilities, not a single straight line, then the entire legal concept of but-for causation is.
It's a myth. It's a useful fiction.
It's a useful fiction we tell ourselves. We are chasing a deterministic ghost in a probabilistic world. And Ralph points out that in certain areas of law, like mass torts and toxic exposure cases, we effectively already judge based on probability.
Right. We look at risk ratios and statistical links.
We don't know which specific molecule of asbestos caused the cancer, but we can say that the exposure increased the probability by a certain amount, and we assign liability based on that.
And this leads to his deepest insight about the human role in all this.
The role of the observer. In quantum physics, it's the act of observation or measurement that collapses the wave function. The universe is a blur of possibilities until it is measured. Ralph argues that the lawyer and the judge are the observers of society.
The AI, the quantum computer, it can calculate all the probabilities.
It can show you the entire distribution. It can tell you there's a 70% chance of liability, a 20% chance of this, a 10% chance of that. But the machine cannot decide guilty or not guilty, liable or not liable.
Only a human can collapse the wave function into a single binding reality.
Exactly. We are the ones who have to look at the infinite possibilities and through the act of judgment, choose one. That is the awesome responsibility of the legal profession. And that is why we can never fully automate the law.
He has that beautiful quote near the end of the course material. Law does not explain infinity. It tries to do justice in its shadow.
It is profound. It reframes the legal profession not as, you know, paper pushers or transactional mechanics, but as the people who stand between infinite complexity and the fundamental human need for a decision, for closure.
So we have covered the entire roadmap, from qubits in class 1 to Q-day in 2, from evidence in 3, the AI system in 4, and finally to multiverses in class 5. It's a lot to take in.
It is a lot, but that's why it's a course, not a blog post. And honestly, if you're sitting there listening to this and wondering, is this for me? The answer is almost certainly yes.
Who specifically should be signing up for this course? Who needs it most?
Well, if you are in law firm management or corporate law management, you need this to understand the infrastructure risks. That harvest now, decrypt later threat is an existential one. If you are a judge or a paralegal or a trial lawyer, you need this to understand the new forms of evidence that are coming across your desk. And if you are a law student, my goodness, this is how you differentiate yourself. This is how you become the quantum native in a firm full of clockwork lawyers.
And as we wrap up, we should definitely reiterate the details. The course is called Quantum Law. It is online. And there is a special bonus for graduates that I think really puts us over the top.
This is really cool and very unusual. Ralph Luzzi is offering a fireside chat. If you complete the course, you get a half-hour one-on-one video conversation with him.
That is incredibly rare. Usually you just get a PDF certificate.
Right. And he's very clear, it's not legal advice, it isn't a formal lecture. He calls it a conversation between fellow searchers. Given his experience, I mean, remember, this is the guy who saw the AI revolution coming a decade early, that chat alone is probably worth the price of admission.
Speaking of price, do we know the tuition for the course?
The final price hasn't been set yet, but the materials say tuition is expected to be modest. He seems to genuinely want this information to get out there for the good of the profession, not to lock it behind a massive paywall.
So, final pitch. Why should someone listening right now take this course?
Look, you could wait for the tidal wave to hit you, or you can learn how to surf. This course is for the people who want to learn how to surf. It's positive, it's forward-looking, and it respects your intelligence as a legal professional without demanding you become a physicist. It helps you decide if you're ready for what he calls the quantum horizon.
And honestly, even if you never litigate a full-blown quantum case, just understanding this fundamental shift from identity to fidelity, or understanding the security risks to your client's data, that makes you a better, more competent lawyer today.
Absolutely. It changes how you see data, how you see security, and how you see the nature of proof itself.
We'll leave you with one final thought from the course material that really stuck with me. Physics tells us there may be many worlds. Your profession is the promise that justice can be found in this one.
That is the job.
That is the job. We highly recommend you check out Quantum Law by Ralph Luzzi. It sounds like a ride worth taking. Thanks for diving depth with us today.
Always a pleasure.